Monday, Friday. I like to picture some of you dudes listening to this. Some of you ladies that are listening to this. I just don't think there's too many ladies that are listening to this that are doing what I'm about to say. Which is, you know, you got this in your headset right now. You downloaded the podcast. Or you're in the car and you're hustling down to some mall. You're trying to drive to some shopping district right now because you didn't get it done. You yourself, this year would be different. I'm not the same person. I believe in personal growth. I'm gonna get my shopping done early next year. I don't ever want to have to deal with the stupid lines and all the parking lots. I promise myself I'll never do this again. And then you realize that the online shopping wasn't going to be able to get to you in time. And now here you are. Same as you always were. Crammed into that mall. Hot in your jacket because you didn't find a locker to hang it up anywhere. And now you're just struggling trying to find gifts for friends and family on the Friday before the holidays. Anyway, I'm off for 2 weeks after this, okay? So please nobody send me "are you fired?" questions. I appreciate them every time because it means you care, but I always forget to say this stuff off the top of the show. I always put it at the end of the show, and I guess less of you listen all the way. You hear the beginning, you're like, all right, yeah, it's this kind of a show. I'm good. I'm out. I'm off. 2 whole weeks during the middle of the holidays. I'm still doing Leafs Talk on Saturday. Then we're taking a few days off of Leafs Talk. Then Sammy will be back for a couple of games on the West Coast trip after January 1st. The 2 and the 3 back-to-back, I'll be off those games. And they'll be back on the Saturday for Leafs Talk. So subscribe to that podcast feed as well. Subscribe to this one. And if you haven't done it already and you want to, you know, give me a last-minute gift, then just leave 5 stars or share it and do whatever. Okay, so I'm going to be quick on the Leaf stuff today. I got Chris Sims. I had a conversation with him yesterday that I really enjoyed about what's going on with some of the quarterback situations around the NFL. And then, of course, looking ahead to the massive game on Monday that I'm a little sad that I won't be able to talk about publicly anyway. Maybe I'll do a little bit more tweeting or some videos or something like that, because that game Monday between the Ravens and Niners is all kinds of sexy, and I don't know what it says about the prospects of the rest of the NFL if the Niners just end up finishing that game, running up the score against them, run the ball all over them, kick the crap out of the Ravens, which, again, is a team that's built around safeties, has really good linebackers. That's what the Niners are supposed to take advantage of. Good defensive line. Niners just beat them down, and you're starting to think, man, this genuinely might be a bit of a cakewalk Super Bowl. So I have a bit of that fear. But no, first, before Chris Sims, before more football talk, Samsonov gets lit up again last night. I did Leafs Talk. Sammy and I talked about it. In the moment, I said, maybe you give him one more start. Maybe you play him against Columbus this week, right? Because they've got 2 games coming up against one of the worst teams in all of hockey. A team that they did find a way to come back against, and a team that really is just a group that Toronto should be able to handle very easily. A team that the players in front of Samsonov should be able to lock it down and say, we're not going to put Samsonov in compromising positions. We're not going to turn pucks over. It's the Columbus Blue Jackets. Remember what we did to them in the third period the other night? If we just do that for 3 periods, or even 2 and a quarter, then our goaltender will be fine. Maybe he can find his level just a little bit. And then we'll go from there. Because what the hell are our options? There's nothing in the AHL, okay? Like, unless you're a Keith Petruzzelli truther, which maybe you still are. There was a moment last year. I looked at his playing time in the AHL. There's not much there. I don't love it. But to me, it's like the strongest case against sending Samsonov down, which I kind of think you have to at this point, because any reasonable person that's watching his game right now, you could have watched hockey for 2 weeks, and you'd look at Samsonov and say, ah, this guy looks lost. This guy, his body language is terrible. The way that he hangs his head after the pucks go in, the way that he looks at his glove when he misses, the way that he's just flailing in the net,
pushing off so aggressively, finding his way out of the crease on a lot of plays, you can just see it. He's not there. He's a guy that has dealt with this before in his past. He's someone who actually has a pretty long track record of struggling as an NHL goaltender, period. He had a great year last year. I think that he was underrated in the Leafs' series against the Tampa Bay Lightning, that he didn't get enough credit for the brilliant play that he had, especially the Game 6. Like, truly, he was awesome. But I don't think you can play him anymore. I think you got to go to somebody else. You got to find another vet. You got to go to the waiver wire. You got to find whatever version of the new Michael Hutchinson is. Because as bad as Hutch was, truly, as bad as Hutchinson was, at least he was able to mix in the odd save. And with Samsonov right now, it's a guy who's struggling. It's a guy who's fighting it. And frankly, the way he's playing right now, I don't know if he'll ever play for the Leafs again. And maybe that sounds stupid. Maybe he ends up being on here 3 days from now and he bounces back against Columbus. But luckily, I won't be here to be accountable for it. My only thing with the AHL plan, and the only reason that I would consider the Columbus game and just hope, is that when I was looking around the league at who they could get, there was nothing that really popped out, and obviously not, because it's a 32-team league, and there's a lot of teams that are struggling in that. Running backs, goaltenders, you're supposed to be able to pick one up and then plug and play somebody. Maybe it's as simple as that. But if you can't find someone that can do the job better, and you bring someone in who does it worse, what are you doing with Samsonov down in the AHL? Like, what is the priority there? Because you can't bring up Dennis Hildeby. I know some of you guys are saying, why not? Why not? Isn't he the big prospect? Isn't he the next guy that the Leafs need to have, be able to come up? It's like, he's played 12 games for the Marlies. 12. He's playing well. He's got a 927 save, a sub-2 goals against. But that's 12 games as a pro. You want him up here on this Leafs team that can play like the way they did last night? I don't know. I think you want to keep the kid playing. I think you want to have the kid in the net. But that's the other issue, is like, if you're sending Samsonov down, is the kid that already doesn't have enough playing time losing more playing time? How are you balancing that act? So the Samsonov stuff is just really complicated. I don't think that there's one simple answer, and it's why I keep being kind of swayed in a couple of different directions, and I've been having a kind of a tough time with it. So ultimately where I land is, you can't play the guy. You shouldn't play the guy. There's got to be someone that can come in here. If Marty Jones could do this kind of a job, which is just adequate, there's got to be another guy that's out there on the waiver wire that you can take a shot on that at least isn't going to hang his head and crush the team from a body language standpoint every time he lets in a goal, who's not going to have that feeling that probably emanates amongst the rest of the group when he gives an early one up that's a softie. I don't think it should be Dennis Hildeby. I really don't know enough about Keith Petruzzelli as an AHL goaltender if he can play better than Ilya Samsonov. But yeah, the Leafs are going to have to figure something out, because it's going to be over a month until Joe Woll gets back. Anyway, I also thought, shout out to Elliot Friedman. I hadn't heard that thing about Brad Tree leaving, how he had brought in a poison pill for Marty Jones that was an extra $100,000 when he went down through waivers that prevented teams from picking him up. Because I always wondered about that one. I had no idea. And Elliot reported it yesterday, and I'm sure it's been out there before, but he mentioned it as potentially Tree leaving's best move. And it's feeling pretty damn massive right now that Brad Tree leaving did that. So good for Tree. Good for Elliot. All right. I talked to Chris Sims yesterday about some of the quarterbacks around the NFL, some of the situations they find themselves in. Here it is.
Very, very, very pleased to have back on the show one of my favorite guests, Chris Sims, former NFL QB and, of course, of NBC. What's up, brother?
How you doing, buddy? Everything good? You feel happy holidays. Hope everything's good with you up there in Toronto.
Yeah. Dude, it's, you know, we're still getting over thinking we were getting Shohei Ohtani and then not having that rug.
No.
Pull. But it's like, now we're getting in the holiday season. A lot of people here love the Bills, so that's good. You know, like, there's a lot of Bills fans in Toronto. So football-wise, things are actually going pretty well. Okay, so I usually try to devise like a theme for an interview, you know? Like, hey, what are we doing? What's the topic for Chris Sims, right? And I couldn't come up with something clever. It's just like, quarterback, what's happenings? Because I couldn't get there. I couldn't find a catchy segment name. I couldn't come up with it, because some of these things are all, you know, very different. But But I really did want to pick your brain about some quarterback situations around football, and I'm going to start with one that probably was relevant more so a week ago, but one that I think I'm the most curious about and wanted to get your opinion on, and that's Justin Herbert. What do you think he needs? Because this is going to be potentially, you know, I think it's five coordinators since he started his career.
Right.
And it's a wide receiver core that in years has had talent, but Mike Williams, you know, not someone you could lean on. They've already drafted guys in high in the law. Like they've taken high picks. They've tried. I think our guy, the Canadian Josh Palmer, is better if he can stay healthy. But yeah, it looks like a miss with the kid Quentin Johnson this year. So when you're looking at the situation that so many of us feel has been underwhelming, and part of it has been that defense, but the offense, it's there too, right? Like we don't quite feel as though this guy is what we thought he was going to be his first year in the league. So what is missing for Justin Herbert, and what do you want to see him get so that we feel like we truly understand whether or not this guy is one of the next great ones?
Yeah, well, he is great. He really is. He's definitely one of the top quarterbacks in football. Now, I think a lot of the problems that we talk about with Justin Herbert aren't really, like, to kind of what you're kind of framing up, are not Justin Herbert related. Hmm. I think that would be the first thing I would say. And, I mean, you're saying it, right? I mean, it's hard to be successful. I mean, first off, his rookie year, you know why he looked really good? He had Shane Steichen, who's without a doubt one of the best offensive minds in football, drawing the plays for him. So that was a big deal. Then he goes to, yeah, Joe Lombardi, which is a basic, like, 30 years behind offense in West Coast, like the same Bill Walsh West Coast offense from 1988. Everybody in football knows how to defend that. That didn't do any good. Kellen Moore, you know, the offense, a little more creative, a little more aggressive, but not so much so where I was like, oh, man, they got Kellen Moore. Watch out there and with the Chargers. You hit on some of the things. You know, one, you know, it's Mike Williams being hurt does hurt them. He's one of their few guys that could go deep down the field and separate that way. And even though he's not a burner either. So that the first thing I would say is they need some receivers that can really separate. Keenan Allen's a mid-range receiver, works the middle of the field. He's almost like a big slot. He's really good, but he's not going to get defenses to, you know, back up, or we got to play two safeties because he's so scary, so we got to change what we do, right? Quentin Johnson's certainly raw and being developed, so we'll see where that goes. Then the other thing you throw on top of the Herbert conversation, I think, is, you know, hey, they're allowed to run the ball and be good at running the ball. I mean, they're the worst at running the football almost every year he's been in the league. So that's never an option for them either, right? Their offensive line is getting better. They are a pretty good pass-protecting group. But then I think even what you talked about the other side, does their defense and how poor they are, yeah, that hurts their offense and Justin Herbert as well. They've underperformed in that area. They've had a lot of games where, yeah, they're always behind or they're always having to come back, and they can't necessarily stay with the game plan maybe they envision just because their defense is, you know, breaking so often. So I think there's a lot of things there, and I think he's super talented. And, of course, that job, just like it was last year, Sean Payton and Jim Harbaugh were trying to become the Chargers head coach last year. Even when Brandon Staley was in the midst of a playoff run, everybody thought, ooh, that still might come open, and that was the hot job. And I think that'll, of course, be a hot job again because you don't have to worry about the quarterback. It's other things on the football team you got to worry about.
So this is the follow-up to this one then. Does their head coach now need to be an offensive-minded guy? Because my fear would be you hire a defensive-minded coach and you hire a great offensive coordinator, but then a year from now, someone tries to pluck the OC, and now we're looking at yet another system that he has to learn. Like, do they have to go offense with a head coach?
I would probably say they should. You know, the thing you say is very real, right? There's no doubt about that. There's not enough good, you know, people want to go, oh, there's a quarterback problem in football. I go, nah, there's not a quarterback problem. There's actually an offensive coordinator problem. There's just very few that are actually qualified. Too many are, like I said, Joe Lombardi still running the same exact offense he learned in the mid-90s and had made no adjustments to it. And there's too many people like that in football where it's like, just because you were taught this doesn't mean you can't add on to it and maybe come up with your own ideas. So, yeah, I would suggest for them to go the offensive route for sure. For all the reasons you mentioned, you got a special quarterback, go all in on it and try to make it work that way.
Okay, then. So to the theme of we don't have a quarterback problem, because I agree to a certain extent. Like, we've seen a lot of backups come in this year and look all right. It's not as tantalizing, obviously, as having the best of the best with great weapons and some of the offenses that we've seen from the last couple of years. But let's go through some of those other guys then that maybe we missed on. So why is there such a lack of drop-off between Jake Browning, who, you know, was a good quarterback at Washington, but not someone that was coming to the NFL with a ton of pedigree, a guy who'd been cut, a guy who really was thinking, like, I think he was, what, going to become a gym teacher, versus Joe Burrow, who is one of the most celebrated quarterback prospects and also one of the most celebrated quarterbacks in all of football. Why are we not seeing a greater divide between those two and their play?
Well, I think if Joe Burrow was out there right now and healthy, and, like, you know, Cincinnati's kind of a famous second half football team here, right? Mm-hmm. Joe Burrow had to go through all the trials and tribulations early in the year where, you know, they were doing nothing on offense. They couldn't protect. They couldn't run. So it's all on Joe Burrow to make it work. And just like we've seen in the two previous seasons, it gets to like early November, mid-November, they start to figure out how they want to play and attack, and the O-line starts to get in a groove, and all of a sudden they start to take off. And I don't think that would be any different, you know, if Joe Burrow was in there. And in fact, it would be different in that it would be even more dangerous than what it is with Jake Browning. There's still plays. I mean, again, let's not forget, I mean, it was 17-3, and they couldn't do jack diddly squat last week on Saturday versus the Vikings defense for a long period of time. Then they got a little bit of the Vikings trying not to give up big plays, let's protect the lead, and they got some prevent offense, defense and all that, and they got in a little rhythm, and they started making plays. He's got a lot of Joe Burrow qualities, certainly. Plays in the pocket, similar release. But there's still a number of throws every week that I watch and go, oh, man, if they had Joe Burrow, watch out there. Mm-hmm. And they don't get to take advantage. Hey, they're throwing the ball shorter, you know, like you saw in the Jaguars game. I mean, the first eight throws of the game were behind the line of scrimmage to Ja'Marr Chase, right? You know, they're not even allowed to – they're not capable of maybe even taking advantage all the way of how defenses are playing them right now, which they're continuing to kind of creep up and take away these short passes. You know, if teams did that to Burrow, it'd be the bombs away show to Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins. Browning is not that big arm quarterback to do that. So they're going to do a little more with the little screens and play actions and do it that way and trick it up to make it happen for Jake Browning. But he's doing a phenomenal job. And he's certainly showing that he's one of the higher quality backups in football. But I promise you, if you were on the field with Joe Burrow and Jake Browning, you'd go, whoa, one guy's way bigger. Whoa, one guy's way faster. Mm-hmm. Whoa, one guy can make a whole bunch of throws that the other guy can't. And that's where the coaching comes in right now with Zach Taylor. They're putting in Jake Browning some very good spots to look good. And, of course, their team has stepped up their game, too. They're showing that they got a culture there that's more than Joe Burrow. And that's why they've gone to two AFC championship games in a row.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. Okay, the next one. I think this one is maybe harder to answer, which is, what did we miss about Baker Mayfield? Because the cap hit is under $2 million, which is nuts. But he's a former first overall pick. And there were obviously struggles with the Browns, but there were also high moments with the Browns. And like, yeah, okay, so he didn't get along with Odell Beckham Jr. Right. And he had a really rough season to that. But then, like, he goes to the Rams, and there was a moment there, too. And I'm thinking about the Panthers and the season that they've had and gone, maybe this wasn't all Baker Mayfield's fault. So, like, he can clearly play. But, yeah, what did we miss? Because we thought this was a guy who looked like maybe he was going to be close to being out of the league.
Well, unfortunately, in the NFL, perception becomes reality over a little while. Mm-hmm. And then when teams and somebody like Baker Mayfield goes through a tough time, and like you just explained, it wasn't really Baker Mayfield. It was a whole lot of crap situations. Teams get scared to sign it because then if it doesn't work, it becomes, well, what did you do? Why'd you sign Baker Mayfield? Look what he did with the Rams and the Panthers. And the Browns didn't even want him, right? Mm-hmm. So it almost is like teams get scared because it almost becomes like a political suicide to do that, right? But this is one where I've argued, and I argued this last offseason. I mean, he was screwed over. He was an NFL. He's an NFL starting quarterback. There's no doubt about that. He got screwed over, one, because he tried to be tough and loves football and played with a hurt shoulder. And then, of course, didn't play very good, but gutted it out. And they used that against him in Cleveland about poor play. So that was kind of BS, really was. And then, of course, they forced themselves in the fact of flirting with Deshaun Watson. Deshaun Watson canceled out Cleveland first, if everybody would remember, and said, I'm not going there. That's the first one off the list. And then they went, oh, no, Baker Mayfield doesn't want to play for us anymore because because we tried to get Deshaun Watson, let's offer Deshaun Watson the greatest contract in the history of football. So the Browns messed that whole thing up, and they did Baker Mayfield dirty. And the fact that it took as long to release him, and they really gave him no options to go anywhere other than basically Carolina at the time. I know Indy was in the mix. Carolina was a disaster, so that's not fair to put on him. And then, yes, he goes to the Rams, and that was an incredibly tough situation. We saw some good things. But, yeah, he's in a spot now where the team, the offense, they can play good enough to allow Baker Mayfield to show his real talent. He's got a big arm. He's feisty. He hangs in the pocket. He's a good leader. And they're attacking down the field right now. And it's a good formula that the Bucs got going there with Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, and, of course, Baker Mayfield's skill set.
Yeah, I love doing what-ifs. And now it just really does feel this year like, what if the Browns just never get Odell? If they never get Odell Beckham Jr., how different is the franchise today? And if they do have Baker Mayfield, do we feel like they're actually in a position where they might be trying to win with the pieces that they put around him? Because this is the next one. Is like, what is working for Joe Flacco? Like, how is he doing this when the last time we saw him play professional football, it was it was painful. I have one of my best friend is a Jets fan, and watching Flacco play for the Jets was really tough. Like, he was immobile, very stiff. It was very clear that the career was done. And then 2 years later, he's coming to the Browns, and all of a sudden, David Njoku looks like the guy, more better than the guy that we thought he was going to be. And the Browns are moving the ball, and he's doing things that the offense hasn't done in quite some time. So, this is a really dumb way of asking it, because I'm watching these games as well, but you have the educated eye. You are a quarterback. How is this happening? How is he doing this?
Right. Well, first thing I'll tell you is don't ever judge anything with the Jets quarterback. I mean, one thing we're learning is it doesn't matter about the quarterback. They could have had Brady or Rodgers or whoever, and that still would have been some crappy offense the last few years. I know that. So don't put too much on the player itself, right? Again, a little bit about the team, the support system. Flacco's got his issues. I don't think you're wrong there. He holds the ball too long in the pocket. He continues to do that. He does throw too many interceptions. One of the things I keep saying on my stuff here at NBC is to go, they need to manage Joe Flacco. I mean, I sure wish I could be anointed a savior of a football game after throwing three interceptions. I really do. That doesn't happen very often.
It's nice.
So one of the ways they're doing it is they have the best defense in football. The defense is phenomenal. And they make plays and create turnovers and short fields. Or when Joe Flacco does throw an interception and the Bears return it inside the five-yard line, they stopped them through a field goal and didn't even let them score a touchdown, right? But I think with it and what they do is, you know, Cleveland, it's a shame their offensive line isn't healthier, but they still have a pretty creative run game where I think teams are worried about that. They got one of the best O-line coaches in Callahan in football history. So I think teams worry about that a little bit, but they got some talent on the outside too. I mean, you said it, Njoku's one of the better pass-catching tight ends in football. Amari Cooper's still really damn good, right? You know, got some scary guys like a Marquise Goodwin. And then, you know, Elijah Moore, of course, has an influence on their offense. They're one of the better screen teams in football. So I'm amazed that they're riding Joe Flacco or throwing the ball as aggressively as they are with him. And I don't know if that's a recipe for success. I'd like to see it a little bit more reined in. But Flacco, his talents, his ability to throw the ball down the field and take advantage of some of those plays, they're still real. They are. And I guess that's kind of how they're doing it. But, again, we do got to be careful. I mean, I know they won two in a row, right? Mm-hmm. But let's not forget, the Rams game, it was a dumb interception at the end that led to the Rams kind of controlling the football game and ending that, right? And then, of course, last week was a little scary as well. And, you know, even made a mistake that was bad in the Cleveland football game when they were about to take control of the game, too. So, you know, it's been good, but it's teetered on a few times of being a little reckless, to your point with Joe Flacco. And that's where I think the Browns got to rein it in just a little bit and play through the defense a little bit more.
Well, the reason why I'm so curious about them, though, is I keep trying to look at the, you know, second-tier teams in the NFL. Like, I think we all agree that the Niners are kind of in a class of their own right now, right? It's just it's really hard to look at the way they're playing, the ease in which their offense scores, the depth of the defensive line, the linebackers, like, the coaching, all of it, and say that there's another team that truly rivals them. But then there's like the next class of teams that I think is like, you know, Cowboys, Eagles. We still have to put the Chiefs there, Ravens. And then it's sort of,
yeah,
you know, yeah, Dolphins, Bills. Like, it's debatable with the kind of the other guys. But all the other teams feel so irrelevant, right? So I keep trying to look at them and our other teams and say, well, who else could actually be a factor? Like, if we're going to have seven playoff teams, which is clearly too many, who is actually going to make
Cleveland?
Cleveland,
though, you're right. Well, Cleveland is one of those. Cleveland has shades of very much of a 2015 Broncos team.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the offense isn't always high functioning, but the defense is going to keep them in the game against anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, they could definitely be that team, to your point, I think, of what you're saying here, in the AFC where, they won the wild card game. And, they're on the road in the divisional weekend, and they're winning 17-14 right now, right? And we'll see how it finishes. But they could be the team that, upsets some matchups we want to see as we go along here because of the playmakers and the scheme on that defensive side of the ball. I certainly think they would be one of those teams you're talking about. There's no doubt about it. The Rams would be the other one if you wanted me to throw one in the NFC.
So I feel too.
The Rams are, they're one of the hottest teams in football right now. Their running game is up there with the 49ers. Kyren Williams, a superstar.
Mm-hmm.
You got to defend that run in L.A. with Cooper Kupp and Nacua and Matthew Stafford now being able to throw off of that. Watch out. You know, their defense isn't like superstars, but there's a lot of good and they're extremely well coached. They'd be the team in the NFC that I'd go watch out for. They'd be the team that I'd say as a 7 seed could go into Philadelphia and beat the Eagles, or a 6 seed and go into Detroit and beat Detroit. They would be the team I wouldn't want. Oh, man, we got to deal with McVay and Matthew Stafford and Aaron Donald and Cooper Kupp. I would not want to see them coming into town in the first round.
So this is why it's like, to me, it presents a really interesting situation for the Niners in a few weeks because they play them week 18, right? And you would think they want to sit all their starters and they want a team that is basically, we've all accepted as, can you believe how healthy the Niners are? Everyone relax. They just make sure the Niners are healthy going in the postseason. But the Rams, and I was making the case a couple of weeks ago, if I'm the Niners, the team that scares me the most in the postseason is not the Eagles. Like, you dominated them. It's not the Cowboys. You own them. Like, it's just that. And the Cowboys going on the road to beat the Niners, it's just like that. So it seems like a miracle to me. The third time that two teams play, interdivision teams, the McVay, the Shanahan history, like, that is the one that would make me the most nervous if I'm a Niners fan. And I think it's going to be super telling what Shanahan and the Niners decide to do that week if they are locked into that spot, right? Assuming they win this game against the Ravens this week and the Rams have potential to be eliminated in that contest, how the Niners treat that ball game, I think, is going to be very, very telling of what they think of the Rams.
I'm very close with Kyle Shanahan. Yeah. I feel like I could tell you what he would be thinking there.
What's he gonna do?
You know, I think you kind of hit on it.
So the
health
plays his guys.
The 49ers is the most premium thing.
Okay, he doesn't play
the guys. That to me is, I don't think he plays the guys. I don't think you risk like, me might get hurt and not be a full Super Bowl winning strength team just to make sure the Rams aren't in the playoffs. I don't. I would play it more on, we're better than everybody in football, like you said, and we're going to make sure that we're 100% ready to go in the playoffs. And if we got to play the Rams again, so be it, but we're going to be 100% and good luck to them. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's how they would look at it. And I think to your point too, that's why this game is really big, right? You know, the 49ers are top heavy, right? They're not incredibly deep throughout their football team. You kind of said it, the defensive line's the deepest spot. Other than that, they are kind of superstar top heavy type of football team. And they play the most physical brand of football in the league. So that's where I think, you know, big picture health-wise is more important than knocking out the Rams of the playoffs right there. As much as I think they probably want to knock them off, I'd still keep the big picture in mind.
Yeah, that makes sense. I will just say that, you know, as a sports fan, you know, you're a former quarterback. Like, you look at this and, you know Kyle Shanahan. You've played in the NFL, you know. You have one of the toughest moments in NFL history. I look at it through just, you know, fan and superstitions. And to me, it's like there's two scenarios that we just talked about here. One is that, okay, you're the Baltimore Ravens. You stole a particular team. And now the team from Cleveland has your quarterback that you won a Super Bowl with. There's some kind of sports karma thing in the universe there where the Browns get in, the Browns get hot, and you face them. They beat you with your former quarterback. And then conversely, the other one is the Niners. You sit your team. You play the rest. You get the 2 weeks off because you're going to have a bye. And all of a sudden, this Rams team that had to play in the mud for weeks, they meet you in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And then they beat you in the playoffs. From a sports karma, you know, weirdo fan looking at the narratives angle, who also believes he's going to catch the biggest fish every single time he's ever been fishing and never has. So, you know, with grain of salt, there's those two things are looming to me in the universe. You know, those are the two looms.
Oh, definitely. I look at that and then wouldn't you love to see the Rams go to play Detroit Lions in round one? That would be great too.
That would be a good one too.
There'd be a lot of sports karma there as well.
Yes, that's a great sports karma one. I even missed that one entirely because I wasn't even thinking about those two guys. But yeah, that's a great sports karma one. Okay, so back to what's happening. The Eagles have felt off all year, okay? And they won these games, and everyone was like, wow, good comeback against Buffalo, I guess. And it's a gauntlet of a schedule, and maybe they're a little tired. But why are we not feeling about the Eagles the way that we thought we were going to when we were watching Jalen Hurts have one of the best performances any of us have ever seen in a Super Bowl, in a loss especially?
Yeah. All right, well, let's start there. You can have one of the best performances in the history of the Super Bowl when you were the quarterback of a better team. Mm-hmm. You were up by 10, and you made the biggest blunder in the game.
Yeah,
that's got to stop. No one's allowed to say anything negative about Jalen Hurts.
I love this because one of my producers is an Eagles fan, and he's writhing in pain, as you say.
If Josh Allen or Patrick Mahomes lost that way, everybody would vilify them.
Yep.
But for some reason, it's a great performance by Jalen Hurts. Yep. No, it was not. The Chiefs sold out to stop the run and gave them looks to where I would tell you that Jalen Hurts to the throne for 550 yards that day and broke every Super Bowl record. That's what kind of defenses the Chiefs played. I know. Right. So now into this year, I think the big thing, of course, is the coordinators not being there, right? I think that's really the biggest issue. They're special coaches. I mean, Gannon was a very good defensive mind, creative as hell, and knew how to pressure the quarterback and find unique ways to do that. You know, offensively, Shane Steichen's one of the best offensive coordinators in football. And, you know, of course, now the new head coach of the Indianapolis Colts, and you see what they're doing there with a backup quarterback in Gardner Minshew. So they miss that. There's no doubt about that. And that can't be, you know, undervalued or appreciated or whatever, because they're special that way. And Brian Johnson, the offensive coordinator, he is a first-time play caller in the NFL. So he's still finding his way and trying to figure things out and how he wants to package plays and do all that. But I think with that, and then you add on top that Jalen Hurts is not – I've been saying this for about 6 or 7 weeks. If you go and listen to my podcast, you know, they were winning games and eking it out like you said. But there was a lot of warning signs that I kept telling people going, Jalen Hurts is not playing as good as everybody thinks he is. There's people open and he's not throwing the ball. There's people open and he decides to run for 5 yards, and everybody goes, wow, great scramble. And I go, yeah, but there was a 25-yard completion down the middle. That was a nice 5-yard run, but I like A.J. Brown down the middle for 30 better. I don't know. Just call me crazy, right? You know, leaving the pocket when he doesn't have to leave the pocket. There has been some bad habits formed by Jalen Hurts this year. And now that they've played some more quality football teams here, it's shown up a little bit, and those teams have been able to take advantage of that. So I think that's the big thing. And then, of course, the defense is a little too simple for my money. There's not enough of – there's a little just – without getting too in the weeds on X's and O's, there's too much relying on the Jimmys and Joes and not enough X's and O's and creativity and disguises to help out the guys on the defense side a little bit. So that's where the defense is struggling. I don't think that can get fixed. The offense, I do still think there's hope for. You know, Hurts has got to be a little bit better. There's no doubt about it. They need to run the football. That's what they're the best at. And they get away from it too often and become, oh, we want to throw to A.J. Brown and Devontae Smith and Hurts. We paid all this money. And, you know, I want to say, you know, the team that throws the ball less than anybody is maybe the most explosive passing team in football. That's the 49ers. They play through the run. They make you defend that. And then they hit you with a 50-yard bomb to Deebo Samuel. But, yeah, it's a little of all that encompassed. And, of course, yeah, Jalen Hurts has got to play better. He's been outplayed by the other team's quarterback for about 5-6 weeks in a row here. And that's not, you know, standard protocol for superstar quarterback in the NFL.
So when the Buffalo Bills fired Ken Dorsey, we all thought this is a pointing of the fingers at all of the wrong people. And since then, Joe Brady has come in and the offense has been spectacular to the point where I actually now feel as though if, you know, you were going to tell me who's the most dangerous team right now in the AFC, you know, you get to pick one team and you feel like they're the one, I would pick the Buffalo Bills. Let's put it this way. Is Joe Brady the next offensive hire for football? Like, is he maybe the coach of Herbert moving forward here? Like, what happened to the Buffalo Bills in your eyes?
Well, I don't think we're ready to go head coach there or anything
it's incredible the jump we've seen here.
Yeah, no, you know, I think it's team-wise, team-wide, I would say. It definitely, you know, maybe reined in Josh Allen from, you know, trying to make it feel like he's got to make every great play in the world to make the football team win. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing, too, is they've taken pressure off of Josh Allen. I mean, Josh Allen, you know, last week against the Cowboys is the first game ever that Josh Allen has had to go. And we go, well, Josh Allen didn't have to make 75 miraculous plays for them to win the game.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I mean, it's always on Josh Allen. That's the biggest problem with their football team. Their receivers are average, right? They got to run the ball. It's an average group. Their defense is good. It's not great. They're incredibly well coached and creative that way. But the biggest thing they've made an adjustment to is, you know, reining him in a little bit. And then I think involving James Cook in the offensive game plan overall more, throwing the football to him and then becoming a tougher football team and being more committed to the run. I think those are the biggest things that they've done here with Joe Brady. His West Coast offense is learning from Sean Payton, and he was there with that and Alvin Kamara and all that, to where he realizes, wait, we don't have a ton of playmakers on our offense. We don't. James Cook is one of those guys that can do that. Why don't we give him the ball more? And I think that's helped everything out, and I think it's helped Josh Allen not feel like he's always got to make a play or a highlight reel type of play for them to win the football game. And now that's giving them some other avenues and making some defenses, you know, play some different schemes, because it's not just always, hey, let's just not let Allen throw bombs and let's just keep him in the pocket so he doesn't scramble and make crazy plays and, you know, we can beat the Bills. And that's big for the Bills. It is. And the Bills feel the same way. Devin McCourty has said it on TV here at NBC. Mm-hmm. You know, I have said it too. You talk to people up at Buffalo the last 2 years. They have all the same thought, that if Josh Allen can't go crazy and win the game for us, that they can't win the game. And that's just not a healthy way to think we're going to go to the Super Bowl that way. So now they're playing a little bit more of a team effort, and I think it's definitely more conducive to them winning and, like you said, one of the most dangerous teams in the AFC right now by far. I'm with you all the way there.
So, and also, is this real for a player? Because I've been wondering about, you know, when you hear the near-death experiences and then people come back and they're like, now I've changed my entire life because I appreciate life more, right? We kind of buried the Bills. Yep. We closed the window. We thought that they were done. They lost that game to the Eagles, and it was like, okay, you know what? It's over. What happens here? Do you think that's actually a factor for the player's psyche, is that they've gone through this, and then maybe there's just a little bit of just easing of, you know, like they know what it's like to already be dead and buried, and they've come back alive?
I think there's something to that. There is. You get that second life, and you go, wait, okay, we got another chance here. We can, you know, capitalize on the things we did wrong. And sometimes when things go so bad, you finally kind of hit a self-reflecting point of just going, like, wait, why am I making it so hard? What are we doing here? Why, hey, this guy's open, just throw it to him. Why am I trying to look for more or make something else happen? You know, I think those are real thoughts that go into the mind, you know, of the Buffalo Bills or whatever, or a football team in general. And then, you know, let's listen, they had some heartbreaking losses. It wasn't like, you know, they've been dominated or blown out. They outplayed the Eagles. They blew some opportunities to win the football game. I mean, if they don't have 12 people on the field, they beat the Broncos. That wasn't a Josh Allen problem there. You know, they lost to the Bengals when they were just starting to hit their stride with Joe Burrow and everything there, and they lost a tight football game. So it hasn't like they've been horrible, right? But they've certainly played better football here as of late. I think it's more team-oriented and fits. Mm-hmm. Offense, defense, tying it all together. And, they're going to be dangerous here down the stretch.
Okay, so last one. We've got a huge game on Monday. And it feels like How much of this game is actually going to go into your mind as to who should be the MVP? But secondarily is, like, one thing I can't stop thinking about when we've just, like, we've discussed the Brock Purdy MVP case and how great he's played and the counting numbers, and Lamar doesn't have those counting numbers. But it's just, like, how much of this stuff goes into who has the best record in the NFL? And I can't get out of my head that two Ravens games that they lost are directly related to how terrible their receivers were and how many drops they had.
Yeah, no, I mean, Lamar deserves to be right up there in the conversation. He's special. He covers holes for that offense at times. Uh-huh. You know, it feels like they're about to hit their stride a little bit here on the offensive side of the ball. They're another team that I would go, like you saw in the second half of the Jaguars on Sunday night, run the ball. Mm-hmm. Stop trying to justify the contract of Lamar and OBJ and the first-round picks of Zay Flowers and Rashad Bateman. Like I said with the 49ers, again, the most explosive passing quarterback in football has thrown the ball the least. Why? Because they run the ball a lot. Mm-hmm. That's where they're built. Same thing with the Ravens. They need to do that more. But, yeah, the award has become quarterback on the best team in football. It's not even an MVP anymore, which mm-hmm. is kind of annoys me.
Yeah,
right?
Me too.
And before I've been pounding the table. Tyreek Hill's the MVP of football this year. You know, now I know he's hurt last week, and that hurts his cases, and we'll see. But if he gets to 2,000 yards, almost every week this year, the first thing anybody talks about to start a highlight show is Tyreek Hill and the Dolphins. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, would be the MVP of football. But after that, that's when you get into the Brock Purdy, McCaffrey, Lamar Jackson conversation. And, yeah, it's interesting. Purdy's been phenomenal. But I talk about, you know, again, Purdy throwing the least amount of pass attempts with the most yards or second most yards behind Tua. You know, that's impressive. But also what I would say is, you watched the game against the Cardinals last week when they played. I mean, his touchdown passes, no defenders are in the screen. So, mm-hmm. That's Kyle Shanahan. That's not Brock Purdy. I mean, he gets to throw to more wide open, I shoveled the pass in front of me for a reverse, and Debo runs for 60 yards and a touchdown. I throw a screen here to Debo, and he runs 50 yards for a touchdown. I throw a screen to McCaffrey, and he runs 40 yards. I do a play-action pass, and Kittle's wide open for a touchdown. So that's where I struggle a little bit with the Brock Purdy MVP thing. To me, the MVP of the 49ers is Christian McCaffrey. Then I would go Brock Purdy. So that's how I kind of feel about it. If Lamar can go to San Francisco and pull off the upset and make some magical plays, he's going to be every bit at the top of that conversation, and that's where he should be.
This is why it drives me nuts about some of these votes. It's like, because people want to maintain the new consistency of the quarterback on the best team, right? And there's all these counting stats for Brock Purdy. But it's just like, we all get it. We know he's better than he gets credit for, was getting credit for, especially at the very beginning, right? Like, I don't think that anybody could just go do what Brock Purdy's doing. But we don't need to overvalidate that by saying that he's the MVP. Like, he's not.
That's how I feel.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
And it's like, and even with the coach of the year stuff, where it's like people are making all these cases, like, Shane Steichen, you did an awesome job this year, man. Like, you really did. The Texans, D'Amico Ryan, like, you deserve credit for the work that you did here with your team. But the coach of the year is Kyle Shanahan, like, without a doubt. If you had your life on the line right now and I was like, hey, go take a coach in football, you would be like, oh, well, obviously I want to take Kyle Shanahan. Like, you wouldn't go get Shane Steichen. And it's like, just because he has talent on his team and gets the most out of his talent, like, again, this guy also has Brock Purdy, who is the Mr. Irrelevant in the draft, and we're talking about him being the MVP. And it's like, that should make you the coach of the year. Like, that immediately should make you the coach of the year. Did you have Mr. Irrelevant? You turned him into a guy who's an MVP? Then congratulations, here's the award for you. But I'm just, in terms of guys who are, like, more valuable, like Tyreek Hill, you mentioned it. Like, he's run almost a half yard on a route more than every other receiver in football right now. Like, the gap between him and the next guy is massive. The gap between Christian McCaffrey and the next running back is massive. And I just, if we're making the quarterback argument, I just think Lamar is getting really overlooked when he's throwing the ball to not Mark Andrews anymore. You want them to run more? They just lost Keaton Mitchell. You know, they've got a rookie in Zay Flowers, a washed up Odell Beckham Jr., like a miss in Bateman. And yet that offense, like that team, they win 75% of the games with him as a starter the last 2 years, and including an 11-3 record this year that should be arguably 11 or like 13-1. And I just, it's the Purdy stuff is, I'm rooting for him. I think it's great, but it's reached a point now where I'm like, we're all taking crazy pills.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. You know, we've become way too, like, quarterback. It's the only thing that matters and all that. And, yeah, I would go, well, if you put Brock Purdy on the Baltimore Ravens, they wouldn't look the same. So, no. And then if you put Lamar on the 49ers, I'd go, yeah, they'd look the same, and maybe better. And that's where people like lose sight of things. So, yeah, I'm with you in that conversation all the way. Purdy has been phenomenal. He's doing great things. There's no doubt about that. You know, and as far as the way the MVP goes, usually, yeah, if we're going to vote on the quarterback that's on the best team, then, yeah, he's the guy. But I'm just trying to, you know, have some group think here, and let's talk about it a little bit. And that's where I think McCaffrey and Tyreek Hill definitely deserve to be in this conversation as well.
Yeah, it's just dumb because now we have just Offensive Player of the Year. So it's like, oh, okay, well, they get that. And it's like, yeah, but that sucks. It doesn't suck, but it's like, it's not an MVP. MVP is a really nice thing to say about someone. Can anybody remember who the Offensive Player of the Year? Can you remember who it was last year? Like, I don't even know. I don't know who wins. That's what I'm saying.
Who was?
I have no idea, and none of us will ever have any idea, because the second that award is announced, we have to clean it from our brains, because you can't use any storage space on who was the Offensive Player of the Year that year, right? Like, you never go to trivia night. You're not hanging out with your buddies at a bar and saying, who should have won an Offensive Player of the Year that year? Like, they basically bring back MVP. Make MVP mean more than best quarterback on best team. That's all we're asking here.
Right.
That's the case.
That's right.
Chris Sims, it's always a pleasure, dude. I really do appreciate the time today. Thanks for sticking around for so long. And yes, I hope we do it again sometime down the road.
Yep, you know, buddy. Anytime. Hope you're good. Happy holidays.
You
and
too.
Enjoy the weekend of football.
You too, man. Happy holidays. Chris Sims, former NFL QB, and of course, NBC. Thanks, Chris.
Great guy. Enjoyed the chat. By the way, the Offensive Player of the Year last year was Justin Jefferson. I went, right. As if anybody knew that other than maybe a Vikings fan. I do remember the year before that. It was Cooper Kupp, because he had the Triple Crown thing going on. Then 2020, Derrick Henry. This one shot. 2019, Michael Thomas was the Offensive Player of the Year. Do not have any memory of that whatsoever. So good for Michael Thomas. There's been a couple of times that the quarterbacks actually also won this award, and I feel like that's like borderline offensive. But yeah, I don't know. I think this game should. I guess I'm kind of rooting for the Ravens in this game, because I want to feel like it's the most valuable player again, not just the most winning quarterback, the best team's quarterback, and that's why I'm kind of rooting for Lamar to have just this awesome kick-ass game where he goes in there and he finds a way to kind of carry the Ravens with 250 passing, 120 rushing, 3 touchdowns. That would be fun. That would kick off a debate to close the rest of the season, because right now it's starting to feel like if Brock Purdy dominates this, or I should say if the Niners dominate this game and Brock Purdy has a really good game and he keeps adding to those counting stats, that we're going to be saying the same thing. All of us, which is, all right, well, I guess you have to give it to him, and there's going to be a little bit of a Christian McCaffrey discussion, but we know how it's going to go, and that is one guy's going to get it, and the other guy's going to get Offensive Player of the Year, and then 2 years later, we'll completely forget that Christian McCaffrey won that award. Probably less than that. Anyways, it is Friday of the holiday weekend, and of course, OLG. For a limited time, OLG is offering the best odds of becoming a millionaire with their $100 ultimate ticket, with instant prizes up to $100,000 and a chance to turn people into millionaires. This could be an epic way to start the new year. God, I'd love to start the new year a millionaire. The $100 ticket, the $100 ultimate ticket makes a great gift and is perfect to play with a group. Plus, it gives back to communities like yours. Get your tickets now while quantities last. Must be 18 or older. Play responsibly. The Detroit Pistons are just unbelievably embarrassing, but it did make me think about the Raptors last night. Quick break, come back, do that, and then Jackie Redmond at 10. So last night, I went 2 for 3 on my best bets, including a little parlay that I posted. But I missed on the Detroit Pistons, and I know many of you are thinking, JD, you bet on the team that just lost 25 games in a row? It's like, yes, I did, okay? I feel very stupid about it. I feel very stupid that I shared that with all of you, that this was a position that I was taking. My thought was the Pistons were at home facing a below-average Utah Jazz team that were without Lauri Markkanen, that were without Jordan Clarkson, that were without Talen Horton-Tucker, Lakers legend, one of Armin's probably favorite players of all time, because he's a Laker that he actually watched. And I went, these guys, they got to be playing for pride here. They cannot allow this to hit 25 games. quarter century, losses in a row, come up and get a W, Detroit Pistons. I watched you while you were once a proud franchise. I grew up watching VHS tapes of the Bad Boys Pistons that my dad would record. I grew up in high school, junior high, when the Pistons were a proud franchise, a tough franchise, with Rip Hambleton, Ben Wallace, Rasheed Wallace, Big Game Chauncey. Surely the Pistons couldn't be this bad. They couldn't be this moribund. They're horrific. They are just painful to watch. The only reason I'm bringing this up today is because I'm not telling you anything that you don't know. I'm not telling you anything that you're like, oh, wow, JD, the Pistons stink? Huh. Who cares? The only reason I mention it is, listen, I've been hard on the Raps, and I think for fairly good reason. I don't see it. I don't see the vision. I don't see the success of Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster since the Kawhi Leonard trade, outside of one draft pick in Scotty Barnes, which was a great pick, and it wasn't an obvious pick, so they deserve extra credit for it, because a lot of people had Suggs, some other people had Franz Wagner, who, you know, I think Scotty is better than both of those guys. Franz will maybe challenge him someday, and those two will kind of have a bit of a route, but either way, it's a great pick. It's a great, great, great pick, and God, where would the organization be right now if it wasn't for that pick? But it is just a reminder of just the tanking. And when you're in a market like this where it's hard to sign free agents, just like the Detroit Pistons are, I thought that. I also thought this is good for Dwayne Casey, because I don't think if you're a Raptors fan, you should have any ill will towards Dwayne Casey. And when he was with the Pistons, they just sucked. And every year their Super Bowl was beating the Raptors somehow. But they were awful year after year after year. The entire time Dwayne Casey was with the Pistons, they won nothing. And then he leaves and they hire the most expensive coach in basketball, Monty Williams. They give him $13 million a year. And they still can't win basketball games. Woof. So good for Dwayne that he isn't, you know, because it would have been a tough look for them to go to Monty, and then all of a sudden the young guys start putting it together, and then they start winning a ton of games in a row. But just a reminder of, that is the one thing, if you're Masai Ujiri and you're looking at this stuff, and you have the Siakams, and you have the OGs, and you're reluctant just to move them all for picks and prospects like the ones we want, is that this market, a lot of us, I'll speak for myself, when I was looking at these drafts, I thought, damn, wouldn't that be crazy to have a Cade Cunningham. When Jalen Duren fell to them, I was like, damn, I'd kill for Jalen Duren. When they got Jaden Ivey, because the Sacramento Kings passed on him, I went, damn, I'd love to have Jaden Ivey. We really do get enamored by some of these prospects at times, and without the right culture around them, yeah, you can see what ends up happening here. And maybe it is too soon for Scotty to take a group of young players and have them start to develop, but either way, it's not all sunshines and rainbows thinking about, hey, what happens if the Raptors trade all these guys and accumulate picks and prospects and all that different stuff. You really can go in the wilderness for over a decade, which is what it's been for the Detroit Pistons. Anyways, quick break. Talk to my friend and yours, Jackie Redmond. 'Tis the season. Jackie Redmond from her home, actually back in Canada. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. Happy holidays. Excited that the cell towers are supporting me right now. We had a crazy storm last night and this morning, but we're good. We're holding strong.
I got to tell you, I would have been crushed if you had to cancel because of a cell tower on the Friday of a holiday weekend. I don't know what I would have done.
What would you have done?
I would have been in full scramble mode trying to figure out what to do and calling in just absolutely massive favors, especially since, you know, we cater this segment to you, right? Like, this isn't one where I can go, hey, don't worry, just fill this in, Luke Fox. So, Luke, my first question to you is, what's the Toronto question you have that you want to get off your chest? He's like, yeah, I live here. I talk about this all the time. I'm like, oh, right. Right, Luke. Thank you. Thank you for your time. Okay, before we get into the sports stuff and your things, though, I thought about this. I don't know this about you. We've been friends for a really long time. I don't know if you're a big Christmas person or not.
Oh, I love Christmas. Yeah, I'm a like big...
The way you said it was so sincere. Girl. Yeah, you were like, I love Christmas. Oh, I take this very seriously. This is not time to mess around. You're like a Starbucks cup gal. Like, you're everything.
I will say I enjoy the right things about Christmas and the holidays. Like, I enjoy the sort of traditional classic elements of Christmas. Like, at Christmas time, I want there to be snow on the ground. Like, the fact that we had this storm last night and there's a blanket of snow on my property right now, I love that. Christmas trees, Christmas music, like, all of that, hot chocolate, like, not pumpkin spice, get out of here. Like, the classics. I'm a fan of the classics, is what I will say.
First of all, pumpkin spice is for fall, and it's excellent, and there's no need to slander it, because it is great. You just have a couple during the fall. You're telling me you don't like it when you put a hoodie on, a vest, something like that, maybe a ball cap. You go for a little walk outside, and it's there's leaves on the ground, and, you know, so you see people's Halloween decorations out, and you grab a pumpkin spice, and you take that first little sip, and it's a tasty treat. Oh, that's one of life's great pleasures.
See, you had me all the way up until you said pumpkin spice. Like, for me, I would prefer to get some sort of latte with some cinnamon powder on top, or, like, chestnut praline is an underrated sauce at Starbucks.
Oh, you're so rich. You're the richest person ever. Chestnut praline? You think anybody knows what that is? This is a common person's podcast, Jackie Redmond. Don't expose yourself. Don't make people forget that you have lost, or make people reminded that you have forgotten your roots, your London, you know, like, gritty roots. Could you ever be anywhere in London and get, what, chestnut praline? You think that there's a single place in London that you could have asked that for?
Any Starbucks in the country will give you chestnut praline this time of year. Any Starbucks in the country.
I don't know. I think when I go home to the Ottawa Valley to visit my family, and if I walk in, well, first of all, they don't have a Starbucks there, but if I did, and I walked in and said, I would like some chestnut praline, I don't believe I would be, I think I would be getting spit, period. That's it. I think I would be getting a huge loogie of spit in that coffee, and they would go, who does that guy think he is? Christmas, because Christmas is for me, I'm very... Like, I hate it. I hate the pressure of getting people good gifts, because I don't like just mailing it in. I don't like giving someone something that I don't love giving them. But the pressure of that is a lot. There's always the travel. There's always the weather. I'm stressed during Christmas. I can't wait for it to be done. Like, basically, to me, the best day of the year is January 2. January 1. That hangover day when you're just, like, in bed and you can order Chinese food and there's nothing left and all the holiday stuff is out of the way. Like, I would argue January 1st is, like a top 5 day of the year every single year.
Wow, you really don't like it. I understand, though. Like, Christmas can induce some anxiety for sure, but it's mostly centered around the gift getting and the gift receiving. One thing I will say that I really don't like about the holiday is I feel, and I don't know where this comes from, but I get anxiety when I'm opening gifts. Like, I really feel like I have to prove to people that I like it. It's this overwhelming pressure that comes over me. So a lot of times at Christmas, like, I am, like, avoiding opening my gifts. I'm, like, trying to, like, do it last when I'm with the family, even as a teenager, because I'm just like, I don't want to have to prove to everyone that I love this sweater. Like, I just don't. It's a pressure that I don't enjoy. So I love giving gifts. I actually don't really like opening gifts in general. I like getting them, but I don't like opening them in front of people. It makes me nervous.
Oh, I hate it. Yeah, no, a gift is great. You and I both share something in common, though, which is why we both have this, is that we've both got extremely thoughtful mothers.
Yes. Yes.
You know? And so, you know, when you open your mom's gift, and anybody that has, like, the super thoughtful mom, you know when you open the gift that she has put time into this. Like, this wasn't some ill-conceived, this wasn't last minute, this wasn't a gift from my dad, which was, like, an ugly Seahawks shirt where he's like, you like the Seahawks, right? I'm like, yeah, I do, thank you. It's like, you know, Seahawks, I got this for you from the team shop. I'm like, yeah.
You always know what's coming from dad if dad
That's
even
what
gets
I'm saying.
A gift.
Exactly. Yeah. And I don't care. And you know what? He had some bangers. There's no doubt about it. But it just, that's what it was. It's some type of sports memorabilia, sports book, sports memorabilia. Like, it was an easy layup thing
No thought went into it whatsoever other than like, okay, what is the team that my son likes? Here, that's the thing that you get. Cool. Awesome. Really appreciate it. With your mom, it's like, what does this person need at this stage of their life that I care for so much that they, and then if they give that gift to you and it's a miss, it's crushing to them. I'll never forget. Actually, this is now we have to do this. Do you remember the gift that your mom got you that she knew you hated right away and it basically ruined Christmas?
No, nothing is coming to mind right now. I don't. My mom is pretty spot on. Okay, give me yours.
So my mom's spot on too. But 1 year, my mom bought me this leather jacket when I was in university. And it was a beautiful leather jacket. But I just was not, and I never have been, the leather jacket type. Like, think about me in a leather jacket walking around, you know? Like, nah.
Yeah, I don't think I can even imagine it.
That's what I'm saying. But she went out and she obviously researched it and she was trying to like elevate my wardrobe and get me, because it was like that awkward phase right post university where you're going to go out in the real world, but I'm not wearing a suit and tie kind of thing. But she bought me this jacket and I'll never forget opening it up, just the look I had on my face, and her just immediately like, you hate it. And I was like, no, but you don't want your mom to have spent money on something that you're never going to wear, right? So she's immediately like, yes, returning it. But then it was like a hard returns process. Anyway, like, I can't even talk about this any further because it's making me feel sick. It's making me feel sick to my stomach.
I have two things to say off of that. So my mom is like very into fashion. So like clothing, yeah, we were always getting more clothes, like not clothes that we needed at Christmas, like clothes that we needed and then more, because my mom just, that's something that she loves, so she tries to like, you know, help us with our style as we're growing up. So we always got a lot of clothes, very fortunate. But one thing my mom would do, and moms everywhere or dads who might be listening, let the moms know, like, the one move I hate at the holidays that my mom does without fail, she'll do it this weekend and I'll hate it. You open the clothes, so you know, and she wants you to immediately try on the clothes. Yeah. And I'm like, Mom, I'm in my Christmas jammies. I'm comfortable. Like, I don't want to put these, you know, denim flare pants on right now. Like, it's the last thing I want to do. But she thinks I don't like it. I'm like, no, I like it. I just don't want to try it on right now. I'll try it on later. So that's one move that moms do that I can't get behind. But I do understand the feeling of getting a gift from your mom where you're like, you're just too young to get that. Like, I remember when my mom got me my first leather jacket. And I was like, I don't know, Mom. I'm like 8. I don't know if I need just like a brown leather jacket. Like, the kids are wearing the Adidas windbreakers. That's what I want. I want the breakaway pants. And my mom was the breakaway pants and not it. And she was right. But I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah. See, my mom is a very fashionable lady as well, and she knows her stuff, but this jacket was just a miss. She's gotten me clothes before that have worked. All right. I know she's probably going to listen to this later, so I just want to say, Mom, like, I'll also.
Amazing leather jacket to this day.
But that leather jacket, it was just very much not me. There's something weird, too, about when you go home for the holidays where you are back in that child mode, right? Like, I'm in my mid-30s now, so it's like you go home and your mom's like, try it on. You're like, I don't wanna, Mama. Like, you're 13 again, Mom. No, I was joking about this. I can't remember who I was talking to about this the other day about how, like, when I'm home for the holidays, if I'm just like downstairs and it's, you know, December 27th, like the day or two after Christmas, and I'm just relaxing, and one of my mom's friends will come over. And then I have to go answer the door. And they're like, oh, you're home? No, so nice to see you. I don't know why, but I feel like the world's biggest loser. Even though I live in Toronto, have a good career, everyone knows that I'm just there visiting. I'm just in my sweats, kind of same thing. I feel like, I'm the biggest loser who ever lived. Like, I need to get out of here. I need to go home and get back to real life. I don't know. I feel like a child whenever I'm home, every single time. You gotta get to the point where you start hosting the Christmases, I think, to truly feel like an adult. Maybe that's the key.
No, I've never heard something so accurate about going home for the holidays. You really do go right back to being like 15 years old.
Yeah.
And you're like, I find like I'm like asking permission for things. Like, can I have a glass of water? Like, yeah, you grew up here. Yeah. Like, the fridge is right there. Anyway.
I'm not that way. I'm more like, I don't mind doing the chores. I'm actually the one who is the chore doer on some. But then, like, you know, your siblings, you're like, why don't you do the chores? All of a sudden, you're, like, bickering with your siblings about who does the chores again, like, you're 50. This is crazy. It's wild times.
The holidays. It's the best, though. I do enjoy it.
Yeah, the holidays are wild times. No, the stress. I'm over it. I'm ready for Jan 2. I'm ready for Jan 1. Give me my hangover after obviously a subpar New Year's Eve, because it's the most overrated holiday of the year. And then, yeah, perfect, perfect. Me in my bed, wasting the day away, thinking about going back to work. That's the best time of the year. Okay, sports. Let's get right into it. Which one do you want to do first? Is it your sports take you got on load, or your Toronto question that you have to talk about?
So I feel like my Toronto question is probably going to go long here because I don't have an answer to it, and I'm not fully sure what my own opinion is. But after last night's game, I mean, we have to talk about this team, because obviously, and I hate that we have to do this in sports now, we have to preface everything with, like, I know the Leafs are a good team. I know Samsonov is struggling, but can we also talk about this thing that is also real without it negating from those facts? Do you know what I mean? So here's my thing. Obviously, last night was not a solid hockey game for the Maple Leafs of Toronto. Just bad, bad, bad. Samsonov is struggling. He's lost his confidence. We know this. Let's just put that to the side for a second, because there were a couple of things after the game that really had me thinking about something that I thought about a lot, I think, you know, during the Austin Matthews era, and maybe just as a lifetime Leaf fan. And that's the fact that the Leafs always play poorly against bad teams. They lay eggs, they don't show up, they take the opponent lightly, they think they can score 5 goals and come back and win. Like, this is just a personality trait of this team that I try to wrap my head around, because after the game, Sheldon Keefe said, we won't forget it, but we won't dissect it. So, you know, when and how do we know when we should be dissecting a bad loss? Because I'm really tired of hearing, like, excuses about, like, oh, well, Samsonov was bad. Okay, but that doesn't explain the atrocious defense that was played in front of him last night. Like, you can't tell me that the Toronto Maple Leafs showed up at puck drop for the game last night, because they didn't. And so for me, you know, I'm listening to you and Sam on Leafs Talk last night, and which, by the way, got a little testy between the besties last night, which I really enjoyed. And you guys were talking about Samsonov, obviously. And, you know, Sam was kind of talking about how, you know, it lets the team down. They don't have confidence in him. How can you play well in front of a goaltender that's struggling? The holidays approaching. And, like, yes, all of those things can be true. But this is not a one-off, the Leafs were bad against a bad team situation. It's been happening all year, and it's really been happening under Sheldon Keefe's entire tenure as the head coach. They've lost to Chicago twice this year, Buffalo twice. They basically no-showed against Columbus until the third period last week. I thought that comeback might kind of turn things around, but maybe it was bad because maybe they think they can always come back. So I know I'm rambling a lot right now, but I think the difference between a good team and a great team, a team that you expect to win a Stanley Cup, is that, yes, a great hockey team will lose to a bad team on occasion throughout the year, but they don't make a habit of it. And so I went back and I looked at a couple of teams, right? Like the Florida Panthers, I think, are a great example, because I think they're a really good hockey team. They went to the final last year. They eliminated the Toronto Maple Leafs. A lot of reasons that I wanted them to be my comp, right? So they lost to Chicago at the beginning of November, right? Okay, good team losing to a bad team. It happens. We know this. You don't have to dissect every single loss a team has. But after that, the Panthers won 6 out of 7 games, and they beat teams like Columbus, Chicago when they faced them again, the San Jose Sharks, the Anaheim Ducks, the Washington Capitals, who weren't very good at that moment in time. So, like, yes, they lost to the Hawks, but then they ripped off a bunch of wins against teams that they should beat. And I feel like for Toronto, that hasn't been the case. More often than not, they are losing to the teams at the bottom of the standings this year. And when you pair that with the fact that, and I don't know if people are still talking about this in Toronto, I know it was a big storyline like a month ago, but like the Leafs still only have 9 regulation wins. There's only 5 teams that have fewer than that. Chicago, Anaheim, Seattle, San Jose, Montreal. What do all those teams have in common? They suck. They're not good. There's only 1 playoff team in the bottom 10 for regulation wins besides the Toronto Maple Leafs. So for me, and it's the New York Islanders, so like I don't really take them that serious as a Stanley Cup contender. No disrespect to any Islanders fans that are listening. But to me, when you pair that all together, I do think it's a problem. So to bring it all together and ask you the question, does last night's loss mean anything outside of the goaltender Samsonov, who we all know has completely lost his confidence?
Yeah, 100%. This is what was driving me nuts about Sam's position and why I was getting so annoyed by it, is because it's like, we get it. The goaltender stinks. But I feel like that's actually the number one just pure fan take, which is always blame the goaltender, the goaltender, the goaltender, the goaltender, because it's easy to assess. And it's like, my position remains that Samsonov is really bad. He's clearly lost his game. He seems to be in a real mental spiral. His body language is horrific. He can't make a save. I was making fun of him a couple weeks ago, saying I didn't think that he, you know, was made of full, like, body, like flesh. He's got holes in his body. I was very dubious that he was going to be able to elevate his game when the Wohl injury happened. I was really, really suspect that he was going to be able to find his game, even with the past track record of when the net was his, he was going to, you know, he turned it around. I can't stand how the Leafs have done this against so many bad teams. It's a huge thing. Like, to the point where a couple weeks ago I was saying the measuring stick games for them are not anymore. It's not the Bruins in the regular season anymore. It's not the Panthers in the regular season anymore. Like, I know the Leafs are going to get up for those games. I know the Leafs are going to elevate to their competition and play tough and usually play solid. Will they have a slow start from time to time? Sure, but they don't have the egg langs the way that they do against some of these bad teams. They still have that we're thrilled to play shinny mentality when they have the Buffalo Sabres or the, you know, Columbus Blue Jackets in town sometimes. And yeah, did they just take care of the Penguins? For sure. But that Penguins game was kind of a big game. There was some juice. It was a Saturday night. They knew it was Kyle Dubas. I think that these guys should be caring about regular season wins. Like, they really should. The Boston Bruins, what did they do last year? They went on a huge winning streak where they just kept their dominance for a very, very long time. Did they peak at the wrong time? Maybe. I don't know. That's not really what my read was in the postseason. I don't think that they, like, played really poorly. Their goaltenders kind of regressed, and the Panthers got super hot. But if you're the Leafs, like, don't you want to escape this trap of the Bruins or the Panthers or the Lightning in the first round constantly? Like, don't you want to see what it looks like if you don't have to go through the Atlantic Division through a playoff series? And to me, the requirement there is some discipline in facing these bad teams. It's not giving up those points to the Columbus Blue Jackets in overtime. It's not losing to the Buffalo Sabres 9-3 and getting completely embarrassed in front of all those fans that drove down. I'm totally with you. I don't know how they diagnose it. I don't know how much of it is actually on Sheldon Keefe's shoulders, because I feel like he bears some responsibility in all this. But I can't keep coming back to the same thing, which is, this has to still be a part of the top players, the Austin Matthews, the John Tavares, the Mitch Marner, the William Nylanders of the world, going, hey guys, going to need you to focus a few more nights a year. Going to need it so that you don't just try to get by on a last second comeback against the bad teams, but that you actually buckle down and put them away early and make sure you accumulate those points. So at the end of the season, you're at the top of the Atlantic, that you've got the one beside your name.
And to add to that, right, like, I think essentially this conversation is really about, like, habits matter, right? Habits matter. And I think also it's like a lot of people just look at wins, losses, right? But it's also sometimes how you lose. And so for me, to bring it back to Samsonov, right, like, did Samsonov just overnight have no confidence? No. What about the question, how did Samsonov get here? Is it because the Leafs laid some eggs in front of him early on in the season, or maybe had some bad turnover games or bad starts or bad first periods, and all of a sudden these losses or these bad goals start to accumulate? That's how you become the guy in the tunnel trying to hide from the media. That doesn't happen overnight and you just become a bad goaltender. Like, Samsonov, yes. Is he Thatcher Demko? No, he's never been Thatcher Demko. He was never going to be. But he's not this guy either. I don't believe that. So how did he get to the point where he is just completely broken in terms of his confidence as a goaltender? Because I do think there is an argument probably to be made that some of the habits of the Toronto Maple Leafs playing in front of him this year, combined with the fact that maybe he's an emotional guy and not as strong mentally as other players at his position, has built up to this point, right? Like, it doesn't just happen overnight. How I would love, and maybe I'll do this after our conversation, and maybe I should have done it last night to get ready for it, but it's the holidays, so, you know, slide me one right here.
Yeah,
but
don't do that. Like, yeah, it's you don't need
if
to
you
do
go
that.
Back and you know if you go back and look at all of Samsonov's, you know, game logs, or maybe you start watching some of his games back from the start of the season to now, is there a trend? Is there a way the team has started games in front of him that has led us to the point where he's a broken goaltender? Maybe. And so that's why I also think that habits matter, because they permeate throughout the team. And so obviously they have a Samsonov problem, right? Thank goodness, you know, Marty Jones has shown up and been a capable goaltender for them, and he's going to have to be unless they can, I don't know, pull a rabbit out of a hat and get another goaltender before Wall comes back. But I do think that those things matter. And so I did want to make that point today, because I do think it's an important question. How did Samsonov get here? Because he was a good goalie last year, and this year he is the complete opposite. The same thing happened to Jack Campbell, who has now gone on to Edmonton, and obviously we all know the story. He's trending last night, so I think we've learned that Jack Campbell just, you know, isn't maybe meant to be a starting goaltender at the NHL level. But I do think that question for Samsonov is still an important one. And to go back to the regulation wins as well, because I forgot to say this, you talk about good teams getting it done, you know, padding their points in the standings and putting themselves in the best possible position for the postseason. The top 10 teams in regulation wins this year, they won't surprise you. Vancouver, Colorado, New York, Winnipeg, Florida, LA, Boston, Vegas. That's your top eight. And they all have, almost all of them have double what the Leafs have in regulation wins. So, yeah. I don't know. I'm over the whole, like, whatever, good teams lose to bad teams all the time. The Leafs do it consistently. It is a part of their makeup at this point, and that's a problem. And we have seen the team no-show in the postseason as well. I still have not forgotten Game 4 against Tampa a few years ago. They're up 2-1 in the series in Tampa, and I think they lost, like, what was that game? It was, like, 7-2 final or something like that. They got blown out in Tampa.
Yeah.
How does that happen? Because it's a part of your makeup, and it becomes that way by the way you practice, basically, in the regular season.
So I've been torn between these two things because, again, the Leafs have continued to accumulate points. Like, they're just coming off of a 9-game point streak, right? They lost
100%.
When the Rangers beat them. So they do find these ways, but I think I was coining them, like, the just enough guys for some point of the season where it was like, yeah, you know what, they find their way to get just enough to make sure that they get that point. They get just enough to push it to overtime with the comebacks and some of the inconsistent play. And I went, you know what, probably being too hard on them at times, but this is the thing that they do need to clean up. And they should understand that it is a championship expectation here. Like, people are done with a lot of the regular season accolades. It's why Austin Matthews isn't getting as much attention as anyone would when they've got a 73-goal pace going on, right? It's just like it's not... It's amazing. He's gonna win the Rocket. He's gonna run away with it. He's already got 25 goals, and yet the market, you know, you say that to people, and they go, "Yeah, that's awesome." There's definitely some, you know, fanboys and girls out there that just, like, really only care about Matthews, and they want to see him do the "Are you not entertained?" pose, and that's it for them. But it's like, for the rest of us who want to see the team win, it's like, yeah, okay, cool, glad you scored. Would have liked it that you also played a little bit of defense last night and then led your team to play a disciplined brand of hockey that was going to result in a win. Like, you knew that that goaltender was in net. You knew that he was shaky. And this is one of my kind of problems is, and I've used this reference a million times with the Leafs, but it's what drives me nuts, is it's just like they're the kid who's smart. They're really smart. And then when they take time off, they go, well, you know, I'll be able to make it up later on the test, or, you know, I'll be able to do this. I'll be fine. You know, I'm smart enough. And you build these bad habits and you don't end up getting the most out of your potential. And that's all I want to see from them is, you know, reach your full potential. And maybe this is it. Maybe that has been what it's always been. But I've just always felt like there's more, and that this is absolutely a part of it, and that they take these things a little bit more seriously, and that, yeah, they show some toughness by sticking up for a teammate that really doesn't have it right now and play a disciplined game rather than just having the immediate excuse, which they've done with other goalies too, by the way. Like, this isn't the first guy. They did it with Freddie Anderson. They did it with Michael Hutchinson. Like, it used to be when the backup would come in, you could rely on the Leafs just kind of throwing their hands up and going, well, this goalie's bad, so I guess we can't play hockey tonight. And it's a theme from basically 2018 forward.
Agreed. And it is also why I really enjoyed what Austin Matthews had to say after the game last night. And I know, you know, I tweeted about it, and I know everyone on Twitter was like, oh, what else are you going to say? I'm like, of course he's going to say it's on the whole team. I'm like, he said more than that, though. He said it's as bad of a loss as he's experienced since he's been there. He called it embarrassing. He didn't have to, like, triple, quadruple down on how inexcusable the effort was from the whole team, top to bottom. So I did really appreciate that from Austin Matthews. I think it was genuine. I think he meant it. I think this guy is tired of losing. I think he's tired of some of the narratives around this team, which, you know, I am guilty of definitely pushing forward, and I am hard on the team. People get mad that I'm so critical of the Leafs sometimes, but it really is because I care. And the only way I can positively, you know, turn this around, because yes, they are a good team. They are going to make the playoffs. They could still win the division. Like, I'm not saying that the Leafs are a bad team, but my expectation for the Leafs is that they win a Stanley Cup while Austin Matthews is a Toronto Maple Leaf. And so the question for me becomes, can you be a great team and still have really big flaws? And the Leafs are absolutely an experiment in that question. But I do wonder, you know, if they continue to go through the type of adversity that they've gone through this year. I mean, it's not just Samsonov and the goaltending, right? It's the injuries to the back end. It's the lack of depth in certain areas, et cetera, et cetera. We all know what the Leafs' holes are. But maybe, you know, in the end, it builds us a stronger team come April. And I can only hope that that's the case, that they've had to weather some storms here through the regular season. They are absolutely going to have to address some things at the deadline, and hopefully that goes well for them. But maybe the regular season, you know, lows and adversity that are real this year, I don't think that they're media driven. Like, these are real problems that I think are objective and can't really be denied when it comes to injuries and goaltending. Maybe it makes a stronger team come playoff time, but I would still like to see them win the division and give themselves, you know, a shot at a wild card team this year that could be, you know, a much more beatable team than it has been in the last few seasons.
Yeah, I'd like it to be less predictable with some of these draft
games. Oh, well said.
I'd like it to be a little bit more, oh, wow. Like, that would be a really nice sign for this team if, wow, they played Columbus tonight and they just showed up from the puck drop and they put them away early. Okay, they're playing a Sabres team that historically has always shown good efforts against the Leafs and cares when their fans take over their building. Okay, you're probably going to have to come out with some real attention to detail to start this hockey game. And I do. I think that those are important measuring sticks, and I think that those are important markers for this team. I was actually thinking about your other sports take that you had to unload the other day with the Eric Johnson tribute video, where I went, maybe Jack is right, because when you just have them for the best guys, it really means something.
I did really like that one.
That was the best one I can ever remember. Like, he cried before the game.
Amazing.
He was super emotional on the ice. It was perfect. But then my counter was, we still have the tribute videos for everybody else, and we still ended up getting the awesome Eric Johnson one. So we can just leave
can
it.
We,
but, okay, what?
Can you, I got one more thing. Leafs related, and I know we're going to move on. That's why I want to get it in here.
Okay.
Can we acknowledge the greatness of the Hall & Oates troll job last night, though? Like, that's,
it was amazing.
That's a top troll moment for me this hockey season. Absolutely. Yeah. Kudos to whoever made that decision, because when I heard that in the background, I was actually, like, it actually kind of broke the tension for me of, like, watching that god-awful game from a Leafs standpoint, and I actually laughed. I was like, that's actually really funny.
Yeah, it was awesome. Did you see, this Twitter account, JFreshHockey, they got a big hockey Twitter following. I think he is based out of Toronto, so I don't know how accurate, like, the numbers end up being, but I think we can all acknowledge that it's at least going to be close. But he puts out a poll every year of who everyone thinks is the most annoying fan base. Did you see that?
Yes, it's a list of all the fan bases of teams and who they hate the most. That one?
Think is the most annoying. But, like, annoying, hate, whatever. And his post comes out that the Leafs are the either most annoying or second most annoying to every single fan base in all of hockey, except for the Seattle Kraken, who didn't vote the Toronto Maple Leafs in the top two. And I went, all right, yeah. I mean, you should love the Maple Leafs, because Kyle Dubas decided to protect Hall instead of Jared McCann, and he gave you 40 goals. So you should be thrilled. You should love the Toronto Maple Leafs. In fact, you should never think that they're annoying. But yeah, the fans, this is an obvious thing to me. There's more Leaf fans than any other fan in hockey, like, by quite a large margin. There's Habs fans number two. That's the second most on the planet. There's a lot of them. And then it's, like, I don't know, Rangers fans, like, a place where there's a lot of population density, but Like, I don't think there's more Rangers fans on earth than Leafs fans, and I certainly don't think, like, passionate, actual, give-a-crap Rangers fans who want a ton of content nonstop. Like, it's, or like, I guess maybe Boston would be three, I don't know. But either way, the Leafs are by far the biggest hockey fan base. Like, you can't even get enough Winnipeg fans in Winnipeg to fill up their building after they lost the team anymore. Like, the tickets go up. They're like, we can't even fill this building anymore. It's like, they almost have a better shot of filling that thing by just being like, we're going to host a few Leaf games here a year and getting the surrounding residents to just show up and fill the arena that way. Go to any rink in the NHL when the Leafs are in town and see who's there. So, of course, fans are most annoyed because they're the fans you see the most. They require the most amount of coverage. They require the most amount of conversation. It's like, that's one of the things that always drives me nuts when people go like, why are you talking about this with the Leafs? Because you go, because you guys want it. Because there's an insatiable appetite for Leafs content. If you weren't such a Leaf fan, there wouldn't be so much Leafs media. It would be spread around the rest of the league. Like the NBA, right? Where people are interested in the other teams. It's not that way. The NHL is built around, media-wise, the insane amount of fan interest there is for one particular hockey team, and that's the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I just thought, that's awesome for the Sabres to get that one over. And I, why I enjoy it is, I go, yeah, their fans will all have a good memory, and it will mean more to them, and they will care more about hockey when they have those little moments against the most annoying fan base in the entire universe. So good for them. I'm glad they got one off. I'm not bitter about it at all. I think it was great.
Say about that poll, and like, you obviously in Canada it's different, right? Like in Canada, the Toronto Maple Leafs get the most coverage by far. It's not even close. But as somebody that has spent literal years covering hockey in the United States, I do feel like I have a bit of a shifted perspective on the whole thing. And I think the Leafs being voted like the most annoying fan base is a bit of like a reputational, like, popular narrative at this point. Because I assure you, in the States, like, I did a 2-hour hockey show for 6 years where all we did was talk about the NHL. And the Maple Leafs got very little coverage for obvious reasons. We didn't air in Canada, right? So we covered them to the extent that they deserve to be covered, based on what was happening in the league. But we focused on the big American markets, right? Boston, Chicago, New York, etc. And let me tell you, there are some very annoying American fan bases, okay? And I do think that the Leafs kind of, like, that's always been the take. And so that's just the take that people have because it's easy and it's right there and it's what everyone has said forever. But I don't necessarily think that it is true. I think there's some competition out there in the form of Islanders fans. Penguins fans over the last decade have been pretty insufferable. Like, there's some fan bases that are just as annoying. So,
no, but that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, is every fan base has super annoying fans. Like, there's just no doubt about it. It's just that there are more Leaf fans than any other fan base. So when you look at it on Twitter, especially, you do a Twitter poll, that's what you're going to see the most of, is Leaf fans.
Yeah, that's true.
And they're going to be annoying. And when your team plays the Leafs in particular, all of a sudden there are other people in your arena wearing other sweaters en masse. There are other people who are loud and obnoxious about it and who have for many years gotten used to the losing. And so they're not like quiet in a loss, you know? They're used to it. They're good with whatever arena they go to. So I think it is the Leafs. Personally, I think the most annoying fan base is the Canucks. Like, I don't even think it's close. From a Canada standpoint, the idea that any fan base could even rival the Canucks is nuts. Like, truly, truly insane. They burnt their city. They destroyed it. And the rest of the country was rooting against them actively because they knew that that was their makeup, you know? And then they tried to blame it on everybody in the surrounding area. They're like, this isn't actually people from Vancouver. It's like, okay, sure, whatever. However you want to spin it, that's your fan base. Them on Twitter for the last decade has been beyond insufferable. But again, I just think it's a numbers game. I think it's just that there are more Leaf fans than anywhere else. And so they show up in more places, and you can't avoid it. Even when you are in the States and the national coverage is like, don't care about the Leafs because there's no fans here. They still are well known to all those actual diehard hockey fans. You know, they know what's going on with that team. Anyway, before you go, is there a sports take that you do want to unload?
No, I was really just wanted to talk Leafs. Basically, was where I was at.
Okay.
So we've never actually covered this. I don't know how much time do we have? Who's
producing this?
Well, one topic that we always said we'd talk about was like career advice, right? Is this okay, the day we actually do it?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay, good. Well, do the career advice. I'm actually getting preachy after you leave, so this is great.
Oh, perfect. Okay, so preachy about career stuff or radio stuff?
No, I'm getting preachy about the season.
Oh, okay. So let's break it up with something a little bit different, because sure. I've been trying to do this thing this year where like I'm kind of going on like more podcasts and stuff of people that are kind of maybe don't have like the largest following or whatever, and I'm trying to like engage more with people that are attempting to work in sports or currently like creating their own platforms. So a question that I get all the time is just like, you know, what's your advice? What's the best advice? And like, should I do this? Should I take this in school? Should I do that or whatever? And to me, like one of the biggest pieces of advice that I always give, and I think you will agree specifically, is that like you really like feedback is your best friend. So when you have an opportunity, no matter what it is, like feedback's not just going to be offered to you. People aren't just going to come up to you necessarily and be like, here's what I thought of this article that you wrote or this thing, this video that you posted on YouTube or whatever. But to me, it's like you need to find people that you admire or trust their opinion or respect and ask for feedback so that you can start to figure out like what works for you and what doesn't for you. And I think all feedback has to be filtered. But I do think that we are like living in a bit of a time where people are afraid of feedback. They don't want to hear things that they could do better or things that could go wrong. And I think people are more hesitant to give, you know, constructive criticism or positive, you know, negative feedback to people, because I think everyone's worried about offending everyone all the time. Like, you should want that.
Yeah, I agree.
I think one of the best things I ever did for myself when I was starting out was if I had an assignment or I was given something to do or a project or whatever, I wasn't always offered, you know, feedback on it, but I went and I sought it out. And let me tell you, the majority of the time, they weren't saying like, this was perfect. They were saying, you know, this was good. Here's, you know, what I would have done differently, or maybe think about this or think about that. And it sucked to hear sometimes that I, you know, would blink 1,000 times a minute when I would be on camera when I first started. But like those hard things are the things that are going to make you better. So like feedback and haters are like two of your biggest tools to me as a resource when you're first starting up. So that's what I would say to people listening that are, you know, either interning somewhere or at an entry level job somewhere, or just like in the first couple of years of working anywhere, like TV, radio, print, whatever, online, like doesn't matter. Like, don't think that you have it all figured out. None of us do. I still don't. I still ask people to critique my work. So that would be my thing, and I think you would agree, probably. And I know that you've got a young squad that works with you, so.
Yeah, but you know what? It's hard with inexperienced people, because when you're coming from a place of experience and you're trying to tell them something, they can get like really tight and really nervous, and they think like automatically that criticism is something, you know. It's weird. The way that I do it is always like you have to like gas up and then tell them what they're doing wrong at the same time.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, you can't just tell them how it is. You can't just tell somebody like, hey, this is what you need to do better. And then here's an example of it. And it's I think there are certain people that you should listen to. It's like someone who actually has done the job, someone who has been in your position, someone who actually is like putting a duty of care into you rather than just like someone who is an outsider who, like, I had one particular guy that used to work here that every once in a while would take a huge shot at me in public and make it seem as though he was trying to coach me. And I was like, this just seems like you're being a jerk. And I think he was. Versus someone who takes you aside and is like, here's how I actually think you can improve. Because what I think is lost is that that's usually a person that sees something in you and is trying to help you. I don't agree on the online stuff. Like, I appreciate when someone reaches out and tells me what they think, or, you know, some feedback from a fan that listens a lot. But for the most time, I just think that what I've seen in people, and I've seen this in broadcasters, like even good ones, they'll get bothered by like the smallest tweet that gets sent their way, and it'll change them when they're trying to deliver their work. And I go, no. Now you've totally let that person seep in. Now you've let that person change what you're doing and who you are and the way that you structure the content. And I think a lot of inexperienced people, they let that one comment or that one thing rattle them, when the entire thing about this is to try to find who you are. Like, who are you? And get that out there in a genuine way, because you're never going to be able to have in this medium anyways. You can fake it with television in terms of a personality. Like, there's lots of people I've met who are on TV that you're like, is that person nice? And you're like, no. It's like, that's, they're really not. I think you can fake it there. I don't think you can fake it here. I don't think that you can fake it in the podcast medium. I don't think that you can fake it as like a true, genuine broadcaster that gets to the top of a pile without finding like what your actual voice is. And so to me, it's like you only gotta, it's like that vampire movie, let the right one in, you know, like only let the right one
in.
100%. Don't let the haters in. Yeah. But take the criticism from people you actually respect and who actually know who you are and can see that stuff. But anyways, yes. We gotta wrap this thing up. This was fun as always. You're going to have a Merry Christmas because you love it so very much.
I do.
The holidays. Yes. You and your ice storm. You're so happy that it's covered in ice in Canada.
I actually have to get on a plane tomorrow. So I'm hoping the weather will cooperate so I can get home to my parents for Christmas with no pumpkin spice, anything in sight. Just regular old classics.
It's too late for that anyways. Anyway, Jackie Redmond, thanks as always for the time. We'll talk to you in the new year. Have a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to everyone listening. And thanks for having me on. I always enjoy myself on this show. I love it.
We love having you. See you, Jackie. That was really good. We'd never done the career advice stuff before, but yeah, she's bang on. She's bang, bang, bang on. It is. It's hard to give people criticism in all walks of life. You know, you always have to try to balance, you know, either a friendship sometimes or... But that's why you should always take time with it. You know, I think that if I was going to say if I've ever made mistakes with it, it's like the times where you don't take the time to figure out like how you're going to communicate those messages to people. So yeah, good stuff from Jackie. All right, quick break. Let's come back and sign off for 2 weeks. I think this is the longest break I've ever taken from the show. Anyways, quick break. We'll be right back. All right. First of all, let me just say that I am extremely grateful for all the people that listen to the show, for everybody that follows me on Twitter, Instagram, the people that DM me. I know I don't always reply to stuff, but I try. I try to engage with audiences and the people who listen to this thing, the 5-star subscribers especially. Like, yeah, honestly, it genuinely means the world to me. And yeah, this is wrapping up another year of the show. I won't be back until January 6th, which is a Saturday for Leafs Talk. So yeah, a little time off here, which I desperately need because I'm tired. I'm so sleepy. But thank you so much to everybody who listens to the show. And you know I mean it. Like, everybody has their times where they're unsure about the work that they're doing. And, you know, the stuff that Jackie mentioned about the feedback. It's like, yeah, I don't really care about the feedback I get from... most people, genuinely. Like, I don't really care too much about the haters. I've never really cared about, you know, what even some people I've worked with think. I want the respect of people I want the acknowledgement from people I respect, and I want the acknowledgement from the people who actually take time and listen all the time. So thank you very much. And I'm gonna leave it with this. It's just like, you know, if you can, find a charity, find something that you can give to. I promise you that you will get no greater joy than giving to somebody who needs it during the holiday season. And I'm not talking about, like, if all you can do is throw a can into a bin, that's great. I think that if you're doing for food drives, the best thing you can do is money. Grocery stores give a special rate to food banks and places like that where they can get more bang for their buck with the groceries. But if you can find just any way, a family, adopting a family, any kind of charity during the holidays, I'm telling you, there's no better way to spend your money. Even if you make a donation in somebody's name, I promise you, you'll feel great and you'll help somebody that really needs it. Anyways, have a Merry Christmas, have a happy holidays, and we will see you in the new year.